Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
It's another week and another episode of Mind Food Radio. Hello, Michael.
Well, what about this weather? It's slowly getting better, don't you think?
I know. Look, all that advice that Angus keeps giving, I've been trying to put the chicken manure out, the dynamic lifter. You still don't know what that is. Spring is in the air, I hope.
Well, he's taking us into the garden again this week, and it's all about planting and how to actually plant, you know, mm-hmm. as we head into spring.
Mm-hmm. And what else is on today's program?
Well, we've got John Gabriel, and he lost an extraordinary amount of weight. And he's written a couple of books, The Gabriel Method, and so we have him on today's show. We've also got
Jacqueline Hellier.
Yes, one of our
favourites. She's joining us again.
All about intimacy.
Yes, a very interesting topic. And of course, if you'd like to win some great prizes, you can jump onto mindfood.com. And if you have a story that you'd like to feature on My Story, you can email Michael directly. How do they do that?
Just head to mindfood.com.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
It's Mind Food Radio. Food. We love food.
We sure do. And I'd like to welcome to the show John Gabriel.
Hi, how are you?
Now, you have written a couple of books, and it's all about, I guess, amazing mind-body weight loss and approaching specifically those who have tried and failed at dieting. Is that what it's all about, really?
Yeah, well, it's about approaching weight loss from a totally different angle. It's about getting your body to want to be thin rather than forcing yourself to lose weight. So most people, they try to go on a diet that through willpower, discipline, behavior modification. What usually happens is you end up going to war with your body, where your body's fighting you all the time with cravings, and that's something I lived through when I was over 186 kilos. But what I discovered is that your body has very specific reasons why it holds on to weight, and if you can address them, you're not hungry anymore, you're not fighting cravings, and it actually becomes very easy to lose weight. And I ended up losing over 100 kilos.
Wow.
And that was over 8 years ago, and I've been the same weight now for 8 years, and I never, ever think about what I'm eating or how much I'm eating or counting calories. Discipline's never an issue. It's simply my body doesn't want to hold on to the weight anymore.
Did something happen in your life, though, that made you want to change? And to, you know, 186, did you say? That's a lot of weight.
Yeah, no, it was huge. I had a couple of really powerful turning points. One was I had been trying to lose weight by dieting, and I was living in New York working on Wall Street, and I was meeting with Dr. Atkins. I went to the Pritikin Institute. Everything I did, I'd lose a little weight, but my body would fight me, and I decided I was never going to diet again because for some reason my body wanted to be fat. So I decided I'd never diet again. Instead, I'd try to figure out why my body wanted to be fat and what I could do to solve that problem. And I had a really solid biochemistry background, so that gave me enough of a foundation to go on the internet and do the research. And then that was in September of 2001. And just after I had that kind of epiphany, was September 11th, I'm just narrowly escaping on one of the planes. And when that happened, I said, you know, here I'm killing myself, and the universe just gave me a second chance. Mm-hmm. So I just let go of everything in a life that really wasn't working for me and spent my life trying to solve the problem. And as I was losing weight, I started to realize I have a really strong message for the world. And the message is, it's not about willpower, it's not about discipline. People that are overweight are not weak or lazy. It's simply that there's a program inside us that forces us to gain weight. And when you live through that, you realize that it's true. And when you can turn that off, see, I've been on both sides of the tracks now. When you can turn that off, weight loss is effortless. So that's been my message now for the last 8 years. It's starting to spread into what my first book got translated into 14 languages, and it's in 60 countries. And I just did an online class this morning for 700 people in 50 different countries. So it's starting to really, people are catching on, and it's kind of exciting to see.
What is the next move? So, yep. You know, for people listening today and they think, yep, you know, I don't want to be as big as I am.
Yeah.
I understand what Don's saying.
Yeah.
What's the next step?
That's exactly it. See, when I first wrote the book, people all over the world were writing me and saying, I get it. What do I do now? So we've created all kinds of support systems. One is a visualization because the foods we have don't have the nutrition that we want. So it's like we're starving on a nutritional level. So it's a way of making foods taste really delicious, but at the same time, you're using good fats that don't get corrupted at high temperature. You're using healthy carbohydrates instead of unhealthy ones, healthy sugars, and you're substituting certain ingredients without sacrificing taste, but nourishing your body. And what happens is as you nourish your body, that trigger goes away and you become less hungry. Learn how to add nutrients to your body. Don't turn it into a diet, but make sure you're eating live, adding live food. And again, don't become a raw food vegan. Don't give up anything right now. Just add real food. Make pretend that you were living on an island 10,000 years ago and you didn't have any cooking device. So whatever was there 10,000 years ago, add that to your plate. So add more real food, and also learn how to live a lower stress life. Take some time out in the afternoon, go for a walk, maybe do some meditating, yoga, or just hanging out with friends, but place some value on stress reduction.
Hey, John, it's great to have you on today's show. It really is extraordinary, and for more, you can go on to mindfood.com and learn about John Gabriel or his own site, thegabrielmethod.com.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
It's Mind Food Radio with Ben and Michael. Michael, we're on to an author this time.
We sure are, and I'd like to welcome to the show Carolyn Donovan. You know, there was a time in the world, if you were interested in anything environment related, you sort of had to, you know, you were considered a greenie and wear love beads and open-toed sandals.
Yeah.
But Carolyn has written a book, Greenies and Stilettos, How to Save the World Without Really Trying. Welcome to the show, Carolyn.
Thanks, guys.
So tell us, what's the book all about? I kind of get an idea, but tell us.
Well, it actually came about very much like you were saying. I've always been a real greenie, and I've been in the modeling industry my entire working career. And that whole time, regardless of where I was in the world or working, I always had a little herb garden going, or I was always into non-waste and into what goes on our bodies and what's going in our bodies and where things come from and how that's impacting the earth. And it always really shocked people because they expected that. I've always called myself a greenie, and people always expected a greenie didn't look like me or didn't do what I did. But that's why, pretty much why I wrote Greenies and Stilettos, because I'm of the idea that being green and being very environmentally aware and aware of what's going on in the world around you and the globe around you is actually one of the, not only the easiest things that you can possibly do when you get into the swing of it, but it's also one of the most beautiful things that you can possibly do.
So do you look at everyday things that you do from a green perspective?
Very much so. Since I've started doing this, I've basically gone, I remember I live at the moment in Queensland, and I'm from Sydney originally, and I, on bin nights, when inner city Sydney, you have these tiny little rubbish bins, and I used to run up and down the street to my neighbours looking for places to shove all my bags in, because I had so much rubbish and so much waste and so much packaging.
Yep.
And now, with the way that I think and the choices that I make, I find I maybe have one or two little bags of rubbish that I throw away, because everything else is either recyclable or it's compostable. You know, all food scraps either go to my chooks, who I just adore, but that's a whole other story, a whole other book, or in the compost, which then becomes beautiful black soil that you put back on your garden. And it all sounds so hard and gumbooty, but it's one of the most satisfying and gorgeous, and as I said, easiest things I've ever done. But one of my big things, and it's something that I've done long before I even realized the impact environmentally of what I was doing, is upcycling fashion. And that is one of my greatest joys. One of the things I'm really renowned for in fashion circles is taking the things that you already have in your cupboard, because a lot of girls have cupboards that are so jam-packed and crammed with stuff, but they'll open it for an event and say, I have nothing to wear. And we actually do have things to wear, and the book Greenies and Stilettos, the whole huge first chapter, which is probably the biggest chapter in there, is all on just giving you ideas, and a few little ideas will spark the momentum of creativity. I always say everyone's a designer. You know, people think, oh, I'm not very creative, but everyone's a designer. And once you get those few little seeds, it triggers off something in you. And my big thing is upcycling and taking the things that you already must love something about it, because you bought it, it's in your wardrobe in the first place, and just turning it into something gorgeous and you, and something that you would be so proud to wear.
Carolyn Donovan, thank you. I'm exhausted listening to you.
I feel like I've been on an episode of Sex and the City.
I know.
What can I say?
Author of Greenies and Stilettos, How to Save the World Without Really Trying. Thanks for being on today's show.
Thanks, guys. guys.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
It's Mind Food Radio, and of course, for more details on anything you hear on today's show, jump onto mindfood.com. Lots of prizes to win as well. And now on the line, we've got Erica Leonard joining us. How are you, Erica?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Hi, Erica. Now, you are a fellow at the APS, the Australian Psychological Society.
Yes.
And you've specialised and do a lot of work in and around drink, I guess, in terms of people suffering alcoholism. Is that correct?
One of quite a few areas that I work in, yes.
And many of the available counselling and detox programs are far too short and effective. Is that right?
I don't want to be unfair to them. They often offer some ongoing counselling beyond the residential time of treatment. But I still think even when they do that, they don't quite get the full treatment that's needed.
And do you think that it's really because not much focus is paid, I guess, to people's purchasing and drinking behaviour, that, you know, they go half of the way, but they don't really encompass the entire picture?
Yes, there's a slight tendency, I think, to look for deep and meaningful issues, which may be all very relevant and need attention, as to, you know, traumas or things which the person is trying to block out of their thinking or whatever problems that they have. But I don't think that attending to those problems is enough. And I think we found in psychology that if you don't attend to the actual behaviour itself, then sorting out the emotional problems won't actually get rid of the behaviour that you're not happy with.
How does someone, though, find that personal motivation, I guess, in mixing with society as a non-drinker?
Yes, I think that's an area that's really difficult for many people, and it's something which needs to be addressed in a different way to the way that it has been looked at. I think that the general community do have a bit of a negative image, and they sometimes refer to non-drinkers as teetotalers or wowsers in a slightly pejorative way.
Yep.
And I think that people who are going to change to not consuming alcohol need to be able to put a very positive light on their social image and their behaviour, and also to give less rather than more attention to it.
I guess it's that same thing, though. It comes back to the individual, doesn't it? It comes back to, you know, their own reason why to give up drinking, and
yes,
also to set their own individual goal.
Well, that's right. And I think sometimes the positive goals aren't defined enough. There's so much emphasis on giving up drinking. No one will give up something that they like.
Yeah.
They need to like something even more. So, for example, right at the moment we're looking at a lot of elite sports people.
Mm-hmm.
Many of those give up junk food and late-night socialising in order to train really hard, because what they want even more is to do terribly well in their sport. Now,
yeah,
each person who's thinking that they have reasons that they really should be not consuming alcohol, they need to find something they do want to do.
Mm. Now, you're suggesting 40% of society drink at dangerous levels.
Yes, I think we do have evidence of that now with these statistics on how much alcohol is consumed across our society, and the evidence on how many people drink on certain days and so on. And the total has to add up to too much.
It's pretty scary, though, Erica. Every weekend you can walk through any city, doesn't matter where you are in the world, and you can see what alcohol is doing to people. And is it because it's so readily available and so cheap?
The reasons why societies haven't sort of cut down on alcohol is because a large proportion of people do want to use the drug, and because the USA tried to have prohibition and it failed.
Mm.
And so people have to actually want something more than they want the alcohol.
Well, Erica Leonard, thank you very much for joining us on today's Mind Food. Very insightful information there. And of course, for more details, you can jump onto mindfood.com. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Well, we've come to that segment in the program, My Story. We love My Story.
That's right. And on today's show, we've got an Australian called Mayuk Tulba. When he arrived in Australia, he did not speak much English, nor did he understand anything of the modern society that we've all come to live in. And in fact, after attending an intensive English language course, Mayuk realised the potential of storytelling, and he wrote an extraordinary book called Beneath the Darkening Sky. Now, he came from South Sudan as a refugee at the tender age of 16, and having escaped from his village at just 9 years old in order to avoid being involuntarily conscripted into the army, Moyuk then spent many years in various refugee camps around South Sudan, unaware of where his parents were or if he would ever see them again. Welcome to the show, Moyuk.
Thank you.
So tell us about the time as a refugee in all those different camps.
Refugee camp is terrible. I was born in a small village called Pechong in southern Sudan. And the life in my village before the war was wonderful. I had a lot of friends, and my life was filled with everything that I needed. But when the war started and I had to run away from my village to refugee camp, it was totally different life, because in refugee camp you don't know when are you going to have your next food, when are you going to eat next. You're always worried about am I going to die, am I going to leave, what is going to happen to me tomorrow. So it was a terrible life.
And tell me, did you find your parents?
Yes, I did. After I came to Australia, I came to Australia in 2001, and my uncle, who was living in Australia by then, was well connected to UN agencies who were working in Africa by that time. So he made contact with his friends, and we found out where my parents were. So I had to send in an application form, humanitarian application form, to Australian government, and the Australian government accepted them to come to Australia as a refugee, and they came in 2005.
That must have been an extraordinary meeting.
Yes, it was. Since I was nine, I've never seen them, and they didn't even recognize me when I first saw them at the airport. But yeah, it was really emotional meeting.
It would have been a lot of emotion and a lot of, well, terrible memories flooding back and all those type of things, hey?
It was beautiful memories, at the same time sad memories as well, because we had to talk about every other thing that we didn't even want to talk about.
Yeah.
Yet we were forced to somehow relieve those memories.
Now, life for you in Australia, coming here only at the age of 16 and not really understanding the language and how society worked, how difficult was that for you?
It was very, very difficult. It was really difficult. At some point, I thought it might be easy to live in a refugee camp where everybody was at the same level. But in Australia, I had to learn English and speak Aussie.
Yeah.
And also, I had to learn my way around, even traffic, how to go to school, how to go to a hospital if I get sick, and how to get around, how to do things even around our house, like turning on microwaves, washing machines. All these things I've never seen in my life. I had to work extra hard to overcome my own fears and face the world as it is.
Well, Moyuk Tulba, thank you very much for your time today on Mind Food Radio. It's been nice to talk to you. And the novel, of course, is called Beneath the Darkening Sky, all about child soldiers in Africa. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this literally is The Mirror Has Two Faces. Michael, this is a really cool interview. 22 books. This wonderful lady has written, Kimberly Freeman, and she's with us on the line.
Hi, Kimberly.
Hi.
Kimberly Freeman is actually not your real name, is it?
No, that's right. My name is Kim Wilkins, and under that name, I've published a number of books. And under the name Kimberly Freeman, I've published 4 books.
And why have you done that?
My Kim Wilkins books are quite different. They have fantasy elements in them, and we just kind of made it, my agent Selwa Anthony and I just made the decision that in order not to confuse the market, I should take a pseudonym. And the pseudonym, Kimberly Freeman, Freeman is my grandmother's maiden name.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came up with Kim Freeman, it sounded like it might be a bloke, so we added the Burley, which sort of made it a bit more feminine.
You've written 22 books in your life. I mean, how do you do that? That sounds phenomenal.
Yeah, it's interesting because I often get asked that question, you know, because I published my first novel when I was 27. So, I've had quite a lot of time to do it. I started writing very young.
Mm-hmm.
I started being published pretty young too.
Mm.
And I get a lot of people, especially people who are want to be writers, saying, oh, I don't know how you do it. I can't make time to write, or I get tired and I won't write, or I feel sad and I don't write, or whatever.
Mm.
With me, it's always been the other way around. If I'm really busy, the thing I really want to do is go and write. That helps me unwind. Same as if I'm tired or if I'm depressed or whatever. Writing is my passion.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing that I like to do. It makes me feel good.
Mm.
So when things are going bad, I write.
So what was the inspiration behind Lighthouse Bay?
Well, I wanted to write a story that my previous book, Wildflower Hill, was the first book I'd really set wholly and solely, well, almost wholly and solely in Australia. I'd set it in Tasmania, and it had done really well overseas. And I thought, well, this is fun. I'm going to find somewhere else in Australia that I'd like to set a story. And at the time, I was going up to the Sunshine Coast quite a lot, up around the Noosa area. And I thought, well, if I set a book at Noosa, I could tax deduct every trip that I took. And so it wasn't just that. I became fascinated by the location and the local history. It's wonderful history around Tewantin and Noosa, that part of Queensland. And I thought, well, this would be really fun. I live in Queensland. I've lived in Queensland practically my whole life, and I'd never set a story there. So it was really wonderful. It was like tourism meets imagination and, you know, has a really good time.
Have you always wanted to write about a shipwreck?
Every writer at some level knows that there's a shipwreck story in them. But I tell you what, when I was researching the shipwrecks stories, I found a lot of one of my favourite things to do when I research historical ideas is to find old diaries and journals. And I found a diary written by a fellow who'd been shipwrecked off the coast of Queensland and wasn't discovered for quite a few months. And he and his wife and their dog had they were the only survivors of this shipwreck.
Wow.
But when I read the actual description he wrote of the shipwreck, for the first time I really understood how utterly terrifying it would have been, like the equivalent of a plane crash for us, like this feeling of being completely out of control and completely at the mercy of the elements. And I remember reading that description and just going, I have to make this shipwreck terrifying. It has to make people want to cry because they're so frightened for the character.
So it's not like Gilligan's Island.
No, not at all, not at all. I mean, you know, in the shipwreck in Lighthouse Bay, the ship hits a reef and literally falls apart. And that was really common. These ships, they were made of wood, hit a reef with enough speed and the ship just disintegrates.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's not at all like Gilligan's Island. And no coconut phone.
Mm.
Kimberly Freeman, author of Lighthouse Bay, thank you very much for being on today's show.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
This is Mind Food Radio. And, of course, for more details, jump onto mindfood.com.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
It's Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking, and today on the program we have Angus Stewart joining us again live from the garden, and today we're talking about what you need to do when you go to the nursery to buy plants. How do you find those healthy plants, Angus?
Yes, indeed, Ben. It is a vital thing to get the best possible start for your plants, particularly if you're planting long-term things like trees and shrubs.
Yeah.
Because the root system is crucial to long-term success with particularly those perennial plants I've mentioned.
Mm-hmm. What happens when you're at the nursery and you're walking along? How do you choose a healthy plant?
Mm. Well, the sort of things I look for are, is the plant actually growing? And this obviously depends a bit on the season, but in spring, which is just around the corner, you're often sort of going into the nursery on a bit of a whim. I should do something to spring clean the garden.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so just looking for healthy growth in the new growing tips is a good indication that the root system is thriving and growing actively as well as the top.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the root system, because with round pots, which are the most common sort of pot that you're going to buy, there is a potential, if the plant is a bit overgrown, for the roots to get to the bottom of the pot and start circling around the base of the pot. And when you plant that in the garden, the roots continue to grow in that circular fashion, and they can actually strangle a tree or a shrub in the long term, because the root system sort of keeps growing, wraps around itself.
Yeah, 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 and it doesn't know what it's doing.
Yeah.
It's going around and around in circles.
Yes, so you really ideally need to, if you're in any doubt, inspect the root system, and often root-bound plants will have stopped growing too in the pot because they're struggling to really get enough nutrient and so on.
It sounds like a bad relationship when you start to think about it, don't you? but you know what happens? I mean, people go to the nursery with the best intention. They get wowed by the colour, and then of course now there's coffee shops there, and they go, "I'll have a coffee as well." Isn't it great? We're gardening. It's a different way of gardening. But they go home, and I bet you a lot of people don't prepare the place for where the plant's going. They just dig a hole and dump it in.
Yes, and I think that's another key element of the process.
Hey, I'll ask you something. The other day I was looking at some native plants and I picked up the plant and the whole thing came out of the pot.
Right. That's obviously
not a good sign. It was pretty dry, wasn't it?
Yes. Look, the plant should come out of the pot reasonably easily, and the roots should be holding the whole root ball together with the potting mix.
Yeah.
And the roots should be just sort of reaching the edge of the pot, and that means they're ready to just jump out into the soil as soon as they're planted.
Yes.
And so when you do get them home, you prepare your planting hole, make it wider and a bit deeper than it needs to be. And what I like to do is just loosen that soil around the edge of the hole.
Yes.
Such that, you know, sometimes with a clay soil particularly, you dig a hole with a spade and the edge of the hole is actually kind of polished by the process of putting the spade down.
Yep.
And so you've got this beautiful kind of potting mix that the roots are able to grow through really easily, and suddenly they hit this wall. And so by using a mattock or garden fork or whatever, if you just loosen that soil that the roots are going to grow into on the edge and at the bottom of the hole, you'll get a much better result.
Fantastic advice, Angus. So this weekend, I encourage everyone, and I'm sure you do as well, to get it out to the nursery, find a nice plant it, prepare the hole and watch it grow.
Indeed. there is no more satisfying process.
It's Mind Food Radio, and Jacqueline Hellier's joining us now, a sex therapist. We're talking about intimacy today, Michael.
We sure are. Welcome to the show, Jacqueline.
Good to be here again.
Jacqueline, I have to ask you, intimacy. Mm. Now, how do people look at that? Because in the old days, you know, you know, these celebrities that we used to idolise had double lives in the 1920s and 30s, or, you know, they sort of had one life and then they had another life.
Mm.
Is that because they were seeking intimacy from somebody different that could give them what they wanted? Is that what it's all about?
Well, yes, I think it's very much a part of everybody's psyche, is that we do want to be intimate with someone and to be able to completely open up and feel present with them.
But you know, when you meet someone, intimacy is alive and well then, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. But at the same time, it's all about discovering each other, right? So when you first meet someone, just finding out that they've got three brothers and a dog is kind of like, wow, gosh, really? Beautiful. Yes, so do I. You have to be careful that you don't confuse discovery and intimacy. Discovery is part of intimacy, but it's not the whole thing.
I'm going to be really brave and put it out there. I think a lot of men, I think we struggle with that.
I think that the genders tend to come at it differently.
Yeah.
I think that old thing that men need sex to be intimate and women need intimacy to be sex has a ring of truth in it. So, for instance, one thing that I often say to couples is, you know, like once the kids are in bed and so forth, don't veg out in front of the television for 3 hours. Actually make a cup of tea, take it into the bedroom, sit on the bed or the couch if you've got a couch in your bedroom, if you've got a boudoir, and actually hang out together. That is a very intimate experience. You're in your own special space. It's important that your bedroom is a place where the two of you can retire to. It's like your sanctuary.
Mm.
Yep. Leave the cares of the world behind. The kids are in bed. They're okay. You know, and it's just sort of some time for just you and me. And then you might well segue into some lovemaking, or you might not. But the thing is, that experience is actually very intimate. An intimate thing between the two of you.
Well, what happens if you've got Neil Diamond playing in the background, Love on the Rocks, you know?
That'll kill it every time.
Yeah, look, if people have lost the ability to enjoy each other's company, right, then you need to start saying, well, why? You know, like at one stage we had that factor. We need to actually rekindle it. And that can be by doing some interesting things together. Because if your life has become nothing but who's ferrying the children to which activity and, oh, my God, how are we going to pay the mortgage?
Yeah.
No one's going to be able to feel like, you know, lovemaking or sex or being intimate because it's just dull, Phil. If your relationship has got to that point, then you need to say, okay, we really need to make some changes here. Go and do a cooking class together. So we've got something else that we can do on our own, something we've got in common, something that we can talk about.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
You do cooking and I'll go off and do roller skating or something, you know?
And then you can reinvigorate things differently.
Yeah. Like to go back to that thing about the discovery when you're in a new relationship, because that's why a new relationship is so exciting, because there's so much newness and there's so much different, you know, like you are actually discovering the person. If you've got to the point where there's nothing to discover, well, then it does become dull.
The interest is gone. And you must see lots of people in that boat.
Oh, absolutely. It's so common.
So what can people do to reinvigorate maybe some intimacy in their life if they're at that level?
Yeah, well, one of the things is actually do some cool stuff together, whether it is a cooking class or, you know, going to the movies or, I mean, you'd be amazed how many people don't ever do anything together, nothing, you know. But, you know, through to maybe read some erotica together while hanging out, having a cup of tea in your boudoir in the evening.
Yeah.
You know, depending on where you're at. But most importantly, it's actually finding time in the day to connect. Hey, hi. Remember me? I remember you too.
She's doing it now. She's doing the psychology. Hey, Jacqueline, thanks for joining us on today's show.
Always great advice, Jacqueline. Always good.
Terrific.
We're very intimate with the audience at the minute here on Mind Food Radio, so we'll talk to you next time.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking.
And now time on Mind Food Radio, a psychologist talking about trauma, Michael.
That's right. I'd like to welcome to the show Professor Mark Creamer. He is actually the former director of the Australian Centre for Post-Traumatic Mental Health. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Now, you've got an extraordinary statistic here that 1 million Australians are suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. What sort of stress is that?
Well, it's a wide variety of incidents that may have precipitated this kind of mental health problem, if you like. Mm-hmm. So some of the obvious ones we know about are things like serious assaults, certainly sexual assaults like rape. It may be combat and war or other military experiences. But of course, it may also be some of the many more common things that happen that are nevertheless a threat to life. So it might include things like motor vehicle accidents. Although the rate of these problems following very severe injury is relatively small, because those events happen a lot, it accounts for a lot of the cases.
Now, statistically, there's only about 30% from that number actually seek help. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's a couple of issues. One is that there's the general sort of stigma in our society about seeking help for mental health problems. It's certainly getting better. It's much better than it was, but it's still there, and I think people are frightened about going to see a shrink, you know, going to see the psychologist or the psychiatrist or whatever. So I think it's partly that, and I think particularly perhaps following trauma, there's less of an understanding and there's even more of a kind of almost a kind of macho culture that I'm tough and I'm not going to allow this to get to me and I'm strong and so on. And so unfortunately what happens is that people turn to other ways of coping, which might be alcohol, for example, or other drugs, or they become very withdrawn and isolated and they cut themselves off from their loved ones, from their family and their friends, and so on. So these are unhelpful ways of dealing with these horrible memories. They affect all areas of the person's life, so it does affect their ability to relate to their loved ones, and we do see high rates of family breakup and separation and so on. It does affect their ability to work, so we see people losing their jobs or not progressing well in their career. It does involve often, you know, substance abuse. So all of these problems then start to pile on top of each other until the person's life becomes very, very difficult indeed.
So for people listening today, though, that, you know, they might have a loved one or a friend or a family member who has had sort of significant trauma in their lives, what can they do to help?
Well, the main thing, I think, is to be there and provide support. to allow the person to talk about what happened if they want to, but not to force them to talk about it. But just being there and providing support, helping out with kind of day-to-day tasks and so on, maybe a help. So that kind of support is very, very important. I think gentle encouragement not to use unhelpful coping strategies like we talked about, and if necessary, gentle encouragement to go and have a chat to their GP or their local health centre and have a, you know, have a chat to a professional.
Very, very interesting. Well, Professor, thank you very much for joining us on today's program.
Yeah, that's all right. Great pleasure. Thank you.
Very interesting topic, Michael.
It is, and you know, it's that classic thing, isn't it, of just putting your hand up and asking for help.
And looking for those tell-all signs.
Exactly.
Well, that's the end of another program of Mind Food Radio. If you'd like to win a prize, you can jump onto mindfood.com. Lots of fabulous prizes up there.
There sure is. And any more information on, for example, the South Sudanese refugees refugee story, Majek Tolba, go to mindfood.com. And also Jacqueline Hallier, you know, one of our most popular columnists, head online.
And she's always got some good information. Now, of course, next week, more great interviews and more great entertainment right here on Mind Food Radio. And if you missed anything today, don't worry about that. Jump onto mindfood.com, click on the radio tab, and you can download one of the podcasts or the entire program and have a nice listen to it on your iPhone or your Android device. That's a big word, isn't it? See you next week.
Mind Food Radio Smart Thinking was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia, produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.